United States versus Michael Imperil. Case number 02-4146. This continues, Judge Williams,
right,
the incestuous nature of this state.
Yes.
Mr. Zafiro.
That's right. And the last case, too.
Mr. Zafiro argued many cases in my court when I was a district court judge, fine lawyer from Milwaukee. Mr. Froling, who will argue for the government here, was a law partner with Ms. Ninneman at Quarles and Brady. After he did a clerkship in the Eastern District of Wisconsin for one of the judges there. Or maybe it was on the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals. He was my law clerk.
That's what I figured. I suspected as well.
I couldn't remember. He came in like right at the time. I think he wanted to quit when he found out I went to the Court of Appeals. He wanted to clerk for a district judge. Wanted to really learn something, so you learn more being a district judge. Mr. Zafiro.
Oh, yeah. good morning. This case could be as simple as my saying Booker and Blakely and sitting down. I don't know that I'm going to make my argument that simple, but clearly, if those cases apply, the tail wags the dog here, as it's done for years in cases where sentences are quantity driven and quantity is found by judges, not juries, the drug cases being the bulk of your work. But Booker and Blakely both make clear that the types of things that enhances from a level 6, which in fact if that were the case, my client would have been out at home with his wife and kids a year or more ago, versus the level 23 that he's got were found by a judge here. I think whether or not this is viewed as plain error, which I don't think you should, because my reply brief was June 14th. Blakely didn't come for 10 days after that, and Booker, I think, a month after that, or whether you look at this as a situation of de novo or whatever standard review you want. This is a case where issues that under the current law need to be decided by juries beyond a reasonable doubt were not. We'd have no problem with this were this a trial as opposed to a sentencing, but now Booker and Blakely make very clear that this applies to a sentencing, and so I guess we'll all wait and see what the Supreme Court does with Booker, but...
You agree that those cases don't apply to restitution?
Correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct, because restitution isn't punishment, and restitution, the case law, I think, makes clear that it's not applicable in that area, but I've raised other arguments why I think the restitution needs to be remanded as well. And so
let's talk first then about the whole this vulnerable
right.
victim. This was a long trial. The judge sees this, what was his name, Henselman?
Richard Hitzman.
Got
60-some-year-old businessman, millionaire businessman.
All right, but also... suffering from a very debilitating...
Paget's disease. I know it well. My dad has it.
Is that the type of consideration that the judge can't take into account if Blakely applies to the federal sentencing guidelines?
Well, I think if Blakely applies to the federal sentence guidelines, all of these enhancements, even vulnerable victim, I think, are matters that need to be decided by a jury, because on the basis of the conviction alone, we have a level 6 sentence. But now we've gone over and above that, just as in Booker, the relevant statutory maximum is not the maximum sentence the judge may impose, but rather the maximum without additional findings. Now that's an additional finding, vulnerable victim. And y'all look for good analogies, and I guess one that occurred to me this morning on the drive down is Donald Trump with broken legs. He's still Donald Trump. He's still a successful businessman. He still has his wits about him. He still has his attorney or other people that he can utilize to check things out for him, maybe not on the same scale as Mr. Hitzman.
Whether he is or is not a vulnerable victim, that's a... We're
a jury
we're
issue.
We're here to decide who has to decide that. And
right.
You say it's an enhancement of the guidelines, period, And that means the, if Blakely applies to the guidelines, that a jury has to decide that unless it's conceded or waived or something like that.
Correct, because, well, again, that is your Booker decision here. I'm looking at page 3 of the slip opinion without any additional findings, and this is an additional finding of vulnerability. And you can easily imagine a special verdict question to that effect, and you instruct the jury and they find yes or no.
Well, I mean, obviously your case falls in with a lot of other cases.
A whole lot,
I'm sure. That we have here. And what would you suggest as the remedy if you're right?
Well, I think that the only remedy, I shouldn't say that, but I would suggest, because the government already has had their bite at it and chose to prosecute this case in a particular way that didn't charge the quantity or didn't charge the vulnerability, albeit the obstruction arises during the trial, arguably. But the remedy, I think, would be that which would apply in any situation where jeopardy has already attached. I think arguably that the right to resentence on these grounds has been waived because they've never attempted in the first instance to make these jury issues. But giving them the same benefit of the doubt that I'm taking for myself here, because none of us knew about Blakely or Booker at the time, at a minimum, now you'd be impaneling a special jury and virtually trying the whole case all over again with that special jury.
Well, not necessarily. The guidelines are unconstitutional. They maybe throw them all out.
In fact, if they're all gone,
just gives the maximum right. Sentence here, and the guy's
time served, and he goes home to his wife and kids.
No.
Well, could sentence up to that if in fact the guidelines cease to exist. But I'm not sure that that's what Blakely and Booker are doing. I think Blakely and Booker are saying, okay, we've got these guidelines. We're not saying the guidelines are unconstitutional, but we are saying the Sixth Amendment still exists. And because it still exists, we're not going to let judges, by a preponderance, looking at even hearsay and other evidence, make these findings. No, we want juries, with the rules of evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt, making these findings, because these are so important that you can take a case from probation to major prison time simply by the finding of these facts. And that's what happens in all of these cases. And I think that's why, hopefully, it's finally being recognized that the tail shouldn't wag the dog anymore. It has been happening. So, certainly I can talk about the other reasons why a vulnerable victim or the dollar enhancement under 2F1.1 doesn't apply to calculate loss. But as I said at the outset, Blakely, Booker, and I can sit down until we have a decision from the Supreme Court if in fact it applies, as I think it does.
Would you address the government's forfeiture plain error argument and how it shakes out under that standard of review?
Well, the forfeiture plain error argument, if I'm understanding where you're coming from, is on the issue of restitution?
I think the government is making that argument on
right,
the
that
Booker-Blakely issue.
Correct. And as I understand Blakely and Booker, and having read up some of the more recent cases, I would agree that I don't think Blakely is going to be the basis for the modification of restitution in this case. Some might argue otherwise. I don't find that in the law. If I'm wrong, hopefully your law clerk find it, but I don't find it in the law.
I'm talking about the sentence.
The sentence. Okay, so you're talking about law, not about restitution, but about law?
Well, there was judicial fact-finding here that affected the prison term.
Correct, the 2F1.1 finding.
And how is that unfair vis-a-vis jury fact-finding so as to meet the plain error standard of review?
The way that that's unfair, looking at this case in context, the context is that you have an 8-count indictment, 5 counts of which resulted in acquittals. And the judge at sentencing finding by a preponderance with consideration of hearsay and what have you that these particular dollars applied to the common scheme or offense of conviction without, I think, looking more critically as a jury might in a fully litigated matter whether in fact these might have been part and parcel of the counts of acquittal. And never mind that we're not netting out these losses as the law requires. The law requires it to be not simply finding a gross figure. The Waukesha State Bank case, case in point, where you have the fact that fudged the actual offer from 230 to 530, changed the 2 into a 5, and therefore the loss was found to be $300,000 simply doing the math. Yet you have the bank's own staff testifying that, in fact, this property, which appellant represented to be worth $530, might in fact be worth $630, and that the bank wouldn't have lost any money at all if the price came in between $400 and $600. And we now know that a local developer has developed it so that it's worth millions. I don't know whether, absent that kind of netting out that I read the case law to require, whether or not this can pass must be even under a plain error standard, because we have some serious problems with those dollar figures that I tried to highlight in my brief. I mean, is that pretty much answered? Okay. So, vulnerable victim, does Hitzman have a lower than average ability to protect himself from crime? I don't think so. You have someone here who has suffered from this disease since at least the mid-80s and yet has been a successful businessman throughout the period of his disability, who has an attorney that he uses on a regular basis, knew what he was getting into here. And I think a lot of these people, granted the jury has found guilt on the 3 counts, but 15% interest in this economic climate means something. It means people understand that these are risk loans. And some of the loans are well higher than that, which Judge Adelman relied upon in some of the situations where he didn't apply the PSI requests that they be included in a loss. 40% interest, for instance, on some of the loans. Hitzman himself, bless you, indicating that he could not be bullied. And essentially, this wasn't a bullying situation. This was, on Hitzman's part, not a vulnerability problem, but rather a bad business decision. And Hitzman himself recognized that maybe with all these photographs, which clearly were the building at a distance, the new collateral viewed from a distance, maybe he should have waited until he wasn't in his current health situation to do this deal with Mr. Rimfro, who he had worked with on a number of deals through the years and had made money with through the years. But that does not render him a vulnerable victim. I believe that the misinterpretation of 3A1.1 would indicate a de novo standard of review. But if we're looking at this as a plain error situation, because trial counsel didn't object as or in the manner that I'm objecting here, and ultimately his conduct might be the subject of motion practice depending what happens here, nonetheless, I don't think we have a vulnerable victim for that conduct which was referenced in paragraph 71 of the PSR. And I point that out because there was some other conduct referenced in the government brief. All that matters is what we relied upon to make that finding, and that was that paragraph 71 conduct, not other transactions with Mr. Hitzman, who in fact could not say whether the pictures were inaccurate when taken because he didn't get out to the property for some time after that, over a year later. The loss guidelines are very fact-intense, and so that unless there is a desire on the part of the panel to discuss any of the cases beyond what I've stated in the brief, suffice to say that I think the major problem here is a failure to net out the loss, because loss is, under the Saunders and Morris cases cited by the government at page 17 of its brief and a lot of other cases, loss is the value of money unlawfully taken or attempted to be taken as of the moment the fraud is detected, less the value of the collateral, and that value of the collateral never was properly determined, even if we're looking at this as a judge decision and not a jury decision, which I think under Blakely and Booker it is. Restitution is, and I see my light is on, an abuse of discretion. Our decision here, I was put in the position of doing the restitution hearing without having been trial counsel or seeing a word of transcript on whether or not the dollars related, but we have cases such as Messino cited by the government where a victim is a person directly and approximately harmed as a result of the offense of conviction, with the five acquittals here, it's not clear whether the reasoning that was engaged in was sufficient to make that finding. Even if we get past that, we still have the value of the property less the value of any part that is returned, or the B1B portion of the restitution statute, finding that has not been made. I'm going to be quiet because I want my 2 minutes or whatever is left of it. Thank you.
Mr. Crowley.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Rick Froling. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the government in this matter. For the reasons set forth in our written submissions, we're asking this court to affirm Mr. Imperl's sentence and affirm the district court's restitution order. I do want to address a couple of the issues the panel raised with Mr. Zaffiro and a couple of the issues Mr. Zaffiro raised on his own. First, the Booker-Blakely issue. Our position, as it's no surprise to the court, is that we believe that the Supreme Court will ultimately overturn Booker. Even if it doesn't, however, that remand is not required, even if Blakely does in fact apply to the sentencing guidelines, because of the plain error standard and the plain error procedures in this case. With respect to that, Mr. Imperl did object below to the loss amounts to the extent they were supposedly including acquitted conduct. The judge was aware of his obligation not to include acquitted conduct in loss amounts. And arguably that's a Blakely, if Blakely does apply to the guidelines, that is an objection which calls into to question who the fact finder is and that sort of issue. However, he did not object based on the Fifth or Sixth Amendment or Apprendi to the vulnerable victim issue, that enhancement, for example. And in fact, as Judge Evans, you asked about whether the judge can take that into account if Blakely does apply to the guidelines. If Blakely does apply to the guidelines, a judge could take that into account because if Blakely applies, the guidelines are not severable. The judge could sentence the defendant anywhere between, in this case, 0 and 30 years on count 1, 0 and 30 years on count 2, and 0 to 10 years on count 8. So it is something that the judge could take into account when determining where within that range to sentence the defendant. If, in fact, Blakely does apply to the guidelines. In terms of Mr. Zaffiro's argument that his reply brief was filed before Booker or Blakely came out, that is true. However, defendants were making similar arguments even before Blakely was decided. Apprendi-based arguments were made in this court routinely, but also note the Supreme Court granted cert in Blakely in October of 2003 before any of the briefs were filed in this case. In terms of whether there was a plain error here, we believe no error was plain. And even if Mr. Imperl could show that.
Well, I must say in that regard that Blakely came as quite a surprise to me. Maybe not to other people, but it did to me. And I never saw that one coming.
Blakely did come as a surprise to many of us. At the same time, an argument has to be made, even if in short strokes, has to be made to be preserved. And defendants were making those
types of arguments. You know how judges love hearing those kind of arguments.
Sure, and I have to admit, if an argument had been made, I probably would have rolled my eyes and said, oh no, it's another Apprendi-based challenge to guideline findings. That said, it does have to be raised to be preserved. And regardless, in this case, Mr. Imperl initially objected, for example, on the basis you can't use acquitted conduct, but then actually said, you know, the judge, you can't make that decision. But then when he got to his brief here, says, well, the judge can make the decision. It's all a matter of how we calculate it. In terms of whether remand would be required or whether this court should exercise its discretion if there was a plain error, we believe that the proceedings below did not were not unfair, did not undermine the integrity of the proceedings or damage the public reputation of judicial proceedings.
Couldn't it be argued, counsel, that because of the difference of the burden of proof in judicial and jury fact finding that that standard is automatically satisfied across the board?
I don't think so. For example, Apprendi errors are found all the time to have been plain errors. And in this case, what we're talking about is, is a judge's fact-finding so unreliable that it would have to be, based on the burden of proof, have to be a plain error and something that would undermine the integrity of proceedings. And that's not the case, and I would cite the reasons that Judge Easterbrook set forth in his partial dissent in the court's recent decision in Messina. judicial fact-finding is not so unreliable that this error, if there was one, is not corrected, that it would undermine the public reputation of judicial proceedings. Judges have been sentencing based on that burden of proof or standard of proof under the guidelines since 1987. It's not patently unfair, and in fact, Mr. Imperl's conduct in this case warranted a 46-month sentence based on his fraudulent conduct, his perjury, his abuse of a vulnerable victim, regardless of whether that's in the guideline context or not. So that's, for those reasons, we do not believe remand is required.
But, well, let me ask you about one of the loss calculations. You know, the $60,000 of Terry Criston.
Sure.
The judge didn't order restitution because he couldn't conclude unlawful conduct caused the loss. Doesn't that show that he shouldn't have, it was error to include him in the loss calculation?
He did include it, you're correct, he did include it in the loss calculation and then did not order restitution. I don't believe the inclusion was plain error in the loss calculation, but that's why we did argue as well that maybe he shouldn't have, maybe that is the closest case, unlike the other calculations. But even if you exclude that $60,000 from a $1.4 million loss figure, you're still well within the range, the guideline range which applied, which was $800,000 to $1.5 million. We were right at the top end. So even cutting out that $60,000.
Right, I think the same applies for the $85,000.
Oh.
The Westland. I mean, I understand. I don't think the position or the argument is as strong as it relates to the Westland $85,000, but we end up with the same, in that same category.
Well, the Westland loss was loss attributed to a count of acquittal. That's
mm-hmm.
true. So if we're looking at it, certainly from a Blakely context, mm-hmm. if Blakely applies, that is problematic. It would also be something which wouldn't affect the range, the guideline range, as it was for the judge.
But that would be plain error.
With that respect to that particular loss, that couldn't stand under Blakely, that's mm-hmm. true. But it certainly was part of the, it was certainly relevant conduct. The judge didn't err on that. So if you are looking at it in a guideline perspective, it was not error to include that $85,000. Just briefly addressing the vulnerable victim issue, as it was brought up by Mr. Zafiro, with respect to that 1997 transaction, the reply brief mentions there's confusion in the record of whether he was in fact immobile at that time. That is not in fact the case. If you look at just the sites provided in the reply brief, that might be the impression, but if you look at all of the sites and Mr. Hitzman's testimony, it was clear he was immobile at that time and couldn't inspect the property. With respect to the other issue raised on whether it would be fair to base the vulnerable victim enhancement on the 1996 transaction when his legs are in the cast and Mr. Imperl falsely promises to re-record a second mortgage for him if he'll release it, it would not be unfair to base the vulnerable victim enhancement on that. It was something that was described in the pre-sentence report, testified to at trial, described at sentencing, discussed in detail in the defendant's opening brief in this case under his factual description of the vulnerable victim issue. So it's not a surprise. It wasn't like the government just put that in its main brief and that was a surprise. It's a basis upon which this court can affirm the vulnerable victim enhancement because this court can affirm based on any evidence or any reason in the record. Unless there are further questions, we ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
1 minute, Mr. Spiro.
Just touching that last point first, again, trial court did not rely upon anything other than the paragraph 71 PSR finding, so nothing else should be before the court today. As you pointed out, it would have been highly questionable, perhaps, to argue what Blakely ultimately did to all of our surprise in front of a trial court. That was a surprise to us all. But the question really is, now, who should decide what a loss is or is not connected with the offense of conviction? And Blakely and Booker make clear that is a jury who should decide that. We can go through every one of these transactions and among ourselves have reasonable agreements or disagreements, but that's not the standard. This is for a jury to do under Blakely and Booker. And if we go loss by loss on this and make our own determinations, that's error, plain error. These are jury questions. Reasonable doubt by a jury is a constitutional requirement. It's not enough to say the trial judge does this all the time, or the trial judge probably did a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Were appointed, Mr. Sotero?
Yes, CJA.
Yes, we do appreciate your taking the appointment and doing your usual excellent job. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, we move to the final